Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, conversations with Stephen Paulson, bassoonist with the San Francisco Symphony and conductor of Symphony Parnassus, which has a concert this coming Sunday. I'll also be talking with Laura Karpman, a multiple Emmy Award-winning composer for film, TV, and video games, whose work Take Four is on the Parnassus program on Sunday. I'll also have a chat with Sergio Assad, who with his brother and fellow guitarist Oder Assad are appearing with Cal Performances next week with multiple Grammy Award-winning composer and woodwind artist Paquito de Rivera. Plus, as this is the first Thursday of the month, can you believe it already? Music critic Joshua Cosman offers his classical picks for the month ahead. Stay with us. Guitar music of Peppino D'Agostino, which you hear as theme music for Open Air, is a natural lead-in for my first guest, a fellow guitarist, Sergio Assad. For more than five decades, he's been collaborating with his brother, Oder, in concerts throughout the world. For their Cal Performance concert next week, they'll be joined by the great Paquito de Rivera. They first got together in 2003 as participants in Yo-Yo Ma's Obrigado Brasil project. Sergio, thanks for taking some time today, and I'm, again, sorry that our schedules didn't quite mesh for a studio appearance. Welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be with you.
You've had some amazing collaborative performance colleagues in these many years of collaborating with your brother, but first I'd like to back up to your earlier days and how you first started in your family playing guitar.
Well, we got it started with our dad, who was an amateur musician and played wonderfully well the mandolin, the Brazilian traditional chorinho. That's where we got started. And I think he was so inspired by the fact that he had two children playing guitar that he pushed us into becoming professional musicians.
Well, you must have had, as kids growing up, there must have been some sibling rivalry there, I imagine.
A little bit. I think we saw that in a sort of personal way because we had different tasks in our duo. I'm more responsible for doing the arrangements, and that has been my task. And Oder is more of this virtuoso-like type. So I write lots of stuff and give to him to play.
Where is your home base then right now?
I am divided in two cities, actually. I live in Chicago, but also in San Francisco, because I'm currently teaching at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music.
Fantastic. And when you collaborate with Oder, is that, does he come and join you, or is he also nearby, or how does that collaboration work?
It's a little complicated, because Oder lives in Belgium. And when we left Brazil in 1985, we went already to two different cities. So I lived in Paris for many years, and he went straight to Brussels, and he stayed there since then. But we travel a lot. We're frequently on the road, so we have time to rehearse. So Wadair is going to arrive actually in San Francisco tomorrow, so we have some little time to prepare for the tour we'll have with Paquito.
Well, I imagine a lot of that comes naturally now after so many years of playing together.
Yeah, we're going to, in another 2 years, it'll be 50 years of duo partnership.
You've got quite a legacy in terms of your training, a direct connection to Andres Segovia. That must be an interesting connection to have as part of your, in your fingers, so to speak.
Yeah, well, you know, we had this wonderful teacher in Brazil, although she was from Argentina. She was living at the time in Brazil. And we studied with her for 7 years, which was the exact the same number of years that she studied with Andrés Segovia while he was living in Montevideo. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, indeed. And now you're teaching at the San Francisco Conservatory. How are you finding the younger generation of classical guitarists?
It's really amazing. I think that the guitar hasn't been at that level ever before. I mean, the kids are, when they're 18, you know, they're already very skilled and very accomplished. So the students we receive here, are wonderful. Now we are creating a nice school here, I think, with my colleagues Dave Tenenbaum and Mark Teicholz and Larry Ferrara. We have a nice team here, and it's a pleasure to be here and work with the Youngs.
Very nice. Now, let's get back to your work with your brother. As a duo, you guys have collaborated with some amazing folks like Yidong Kramer, Yo-Yo Ma, as I mentioned, which is an ongoing collaboration, Dawn Upshaw, Nadja Selena Sonnenberg, the Turtle Island Quartet, and Paquito de Rivera. Now, let's talk about how you guys first met, Paquito.
We were invited to be part of the Yo-Yo Ma's project called Obrigado Brasil. Actually, that was an amazing project because he reunited many Brazilians for his project. He got the only non-Brazilian was actually Paquito. But Paquito is Brazilian by heart, and he knows Brazilian music very well. So in that, we made three different tours, one to Asia, one to Europe, and a couple of tours here in the U.S., actually. And you know, you're a tour, you're on the road, you're backstage, you're playing Brazilian music with the Brazilian players, and Paquito is joining us all the time. So why not, you know, just to put up a trio?
Sure, and being brought together by the extremely eclectic Yo-Yo Ma, he's quite a collaborator himself.
Yes. So, and we actually, most recently, it was last year, he did another project called Viva Brasil, and we toured here a few cities in the U.S. But this time was just Cassie Stott, a percussion player, and the two of us with him. It was really nice.
Mm-hmm. And this program at Zellerbach Hall next Wednesday is called Dances from the New World. How did this particular program evolve?
Well, I think Paquito and I, we share a lot the same sort of roots, you know. Actually, the island of Cuba has a lot of similarities to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Culture is very similar. And we love the same music, so we thought that the best we could do is just to, you know, play some Latin American music, music from the Caribbean islands, and music from the U.S. You know, there were so many contributions from all these countries. That's actually, we are going to give just a little idea of what we could do, you know, is just because there's so much to cover.
I was going to ask, to winnow things down, how are things coming together for Wednesday then? Are you still in the selection process? I noticed that the exact program wasn't posted.
That's what we're going to be playing. There will be selections from Argentina, Paraguay. There will be some music from Brazil, some music from Cuba, some music from the U.S., pretty much some music written actually by Paquito himself. And I did a lot of the arrangements that we're going to play.
I was going to ask about your arranging history. Do you find arranging works that have already established more interesting than composing your own, or are you looking at the masters and finding inspiration to your own writing?
I like to write music, but I think it's a pleasure to arrange as well. Somehow, arranging is a way of make a contribution to established compositions, and you can give your own imprint in there and then just translate that to your own world. And I love arranging as well.
Well, I'm glad you're being reunited with your brother for some concerts here. What happens after these performances?
We keep on the road. We have other things line up, like even after this tour is over, we have other chamber concerts to play here in the U.S., like with my daughter Clarice, who is a wonderful musician as well, and with Joshua Roman, who is a wonderful cellist, young, very young. We'll be playing other cities here in the U.S. as well, so it's a blend of musicians and different tours.
Well, you can learn more about your collaborations and your upcoming concerts at assadbrothers.com. This performance at Zellerbach Hall is through Cal Performances. Information for tickets, calperformances.org. Sergio, I want to thank you for taking just a little bit of time with me today. And again, I want you to promise that next time you've got something coming up, we'll have a live performance here at KLW.
Perfect. Well, it was a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Okay, Sergio.
Opportunity. Okay.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sergio Assad performing with his brother, Oder Assad. The Assad brothers appearing with Paquito de Rivera, Dances from the New World. A legendary jazz clarinetist, Latino Paquito de Rivera, is joined by the Brazilian brothers for a program of dances at Cal Performances. The concert is next Wednesday, April 10th at 8 p.m. Once again, tickets at calperformances.org. Let's hear some music of the Assad brothers here on Open Air. I'm pleased to be joined by Stephen Paulson, conductor of Symphony Parnassus, which has its spring concert this Sunday at Old First Church here in San Francisco for a concert entitled Musical Freedoms, with works by Ernest Chausson, Johannes Brahms, and Laura Karpman, who will join the conversation by phone from Italy shortly. Stephen Paulson has also been bassoonist with the San Francisco Symphony for 35 years as principal bassoonist. We'll talk about his time with that august organization as well after we chat about his work on the podium with Parnassus. Stephen, it's a great pleasure to welcome you back to KLW.
It's great to be here, David, and thanks for inviting me to be on Open Air.
Of course. You are in your 14th season as conductor of Symphony Parnassus, an organization that started in 1989 as the UCSF Orchestra. Now, for listeners who may not know about the ensemble, could you share with us a bit of the history of the group and its evolution?
Well, San Francisco isn't the only city that has a doctor's orchestra. I think New York has one, L.A. has one, Boston, and probably many other cities. Quite a few of them have a good musical background, and they like to play, and they've been so busy with medical school that they didn't have quite enough time to practice, but then after a while, they want to pick up their instruments again. That's how my orchestra started. It was started first after World War II and then folded for a while and was reconstituted in 1989 and has been in existence ever since. I auditioned and was hired as music director in 1998, and it was shortly after that that the name changed. We needed to become independent of the university because we were not allowed to do any fundraising with UCSF in our name, so we became Symphony Parnassus, so that we were more independent, but we still get quite a bit of our membership from the UCSF community.
And actually taking your name from the street on which the medical campus of UCSF sits.
That's true.
As well as referring to Greek mythology, I understand.
Which had to do with medicine and music, which makes sense to me.
It certainly does. Well, it continues, as you said, to be an all-volunteer orchestra with a healthy helping, so to speak, of healthcare professionals in its midst.
Yes, that's true.
We'll talk about your three decades and then some with the San Francisco Symphony and the bassoon section shortly, but I imagine that playing under Michael Tilson Thomas and all of the other incredible parade of internationally renowned conductors is basically a free conducting masterclass for every rehearsal and concert that you've been involved in. What's the takeaway from that? And I imagine that Parnassus reaps the benefits.
I think they do in some ways. I think if you study conducting seriously, you're studying really how to make the moves, what to do and what not to do. And what I've learned mostly from the guest conductors, especially Michael Tilson Thomas, is how to take the music apart and put it back together again in such a way as that it's the most possible communicative to the audience. I love the way MTT will dissect a phrase, especially when he's working with an entire string section, and do it in a way that it sounds like one soloist improvising, and yet it's everybody playing at the same time. And there are techniques for doing that, and I've learned as much as I can about that especially.
That's interesting. Now, this program on Sunday of Symphony Parnassus is called Musical Freedoms. Are all of the Parnassus programs tied to a particular theme, and how did this particular one congeal?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I don't always think of the theme when I'm creating a program, but when our PR department, that is our volunteer PR department, which is consists of people who play in the orchestra, want to present the event to the public, they find a theme that seems to link everything together.
So we have Ernest Chausson's poem on the program?
Yes. That's a beautiful piece. I've only played it a couple of times in my life, and this is the first time I've conducted it. It's just a gorgeous piece. For most of my musical career, I didn't take French Romanticism as seriously as I should have, but I'm finally learning. And this piece, which uses a lot of post-Wagnerian harmonies, and in many ways foreshadows Debussy's more experimental stuff that was to come later. You know, Chausson would have lived a lot longer. He died in a bicycle accident at the age of 40 or something like that in 1899. So he may have progressed parallel to Debussy, but this is...
I did not know that, and as a bike commuter, I'm partially traumatized at the moment.
Take care of your... I'm sure he wasn't wearing his helmet, unfortunately.
Yeah, so. Indeed. Also on the program, Johannes Brahms' wonderful serenade.
Yeah, well, Brahms already had it in him to write a great symphony at this point, but he was so intimidated by the gigantic image that the Beethoven symphonies made that he felt he wasn't ready. So he wrote a couple of serenades and finally produced his first symphony at the age of 40. So these serenades, he deliberately made them a lighter kind of a spirit than a big symphony, but the skill and the beauty that are in this serenade are equal to the greatest symphony.
And also on the program, a work by Laura Karpman. Now, we're joined by phone now with the composer Laura Karpman from Italy. Laura is a four-time Emmy Award-winning composer whose extensive career spans the worlds of concert, stage, theater, film, television, and video game music. She's a Juilliard grad who, when she wasn't studying with Milton Babbitt, was scat singing in some of Manhattan's jazz clubs. She's also studied with William Bolcom and attended classes given by the great Nadia Boulanger, which we'll speak about in a bit, and which she called a life-changing experience. She's worked with Steven Spielberg on his Emmy-winning 20-hour miniseries Taken, as well as the PBS acclaimed series The Living Edens, for which she received 9 Emmy nominations. And among others, she scored music for the Halo 3 and EverQuest 2 video games. I should also mention that Laura has collaborated locally with the Kitchen Sisters for The Hidden World of Girls, which was featured in last summer's Cabrillo Music Festival. Laura, thank you for staying up into the wee hours in Positano, Italy.
My pleasure, my pleasure. I have to interrupt because I had no idea about the UCSF connection. You know, my father, who's 86 years old, went there.
Oh, he's the person to whom the piece is dedicated.
It is, and so it makes an even deeper connection there. How crazy is that?
That's wonderful. Now, browsing your credits, Laura, I'm reminded of a Tom Lehrer comment. He said something like, "It's people like you who make you realize how little people like me have accomplished." Now, what are you working on in Italy, or are you maybe taking a well-deserved breather?
Well, I tell you, I'm actually in the middle of a really, really interesting experience. I've been living over here this year, not in Italy, but in Spain. Berklee College of Music has launched its graduate programs in Spain for a variety of reasons. So I started as a visiting professor, and then I took over as interim program director. You know, so for the next few months, I'm directing the film scoring program here in Valencia, Spain. And I just came from New York, so we had a few days off. We decided to come to Italy. So it sounds very glamorous. And I have to say, at this moment, staring out the window into the Mediterranean, looking up on this hill in Positano, I think it is a little glamorous. What can I tell you?
Well, good for you. You deserve that, I think.
Thank you.
Now, what was your inspiration for this work called Take 4, which is on this Sunday's program? The title says 4 woodwinds. Now, is that for any 4 woodwinds? And why did you go with the saxophone quartet?
Well, I tell you, originally it was a commission from the Premier Sax Quartet for the San Jose Chamber Orchestra. And so I had a commission for four saxes and string orchestra. And so I decided to base each movement on a great sax player, you know, Stan Getz, John Coltrane, Jerry Mulligan, Charlie Parker, kind of on their styles and on some of the sort of their compositional prowess. I'm sort of beginning to believe of late that improvisation is more composition than improvisation. I think that a lot of these performers have been, you know, kind of, I don't want to say relegated as improvisers, but sort of thought of as improvisers when in fact they were, you know, really, really composers. I mean, nobody can say that kind of middle section of my favorite things of John Coltrane was written by Richard Rodgers. It just wasn't. So this is kind of some of the stuff I've been thinking about. Then I was composer in residence with the Young Musicians Foundation Orchestra, and they wanted me to arrange the piece for four woodwinds, and so that's the version that hopefully many of you will be hearing on Sunday.
The arrangement that Laura made for the woodwinds gives our principal woodwinds of Parnassus the opportunity to double on other instruments. So it's even more fun because the audience is going to see a whole lot of lumber up there on the stage when these folks are playing. Darcy Mironov will be playing flute and alto flute. Shelton Sugar will be playing oboe and English horn. James Pitko will be playing clarinet and bass clarinet. And Amy Duxbury will be playing bassoon and contrabassoon.
So it's for a reduced size orchestra.
Just strings.
Oh,
and
wow,
that's
okay.
Another interesting feature. Laura left out the drums, and the people in the string and wind sections have to provide all the jazzy rhythms themselves.
They do. It's always risky to ask string players to do that, but you know, it's a lot of fun because actually in this piece they do a kind of a thing with their bows, and it's pretty effective. I think it works well.
Well, neat. Now, this is part of a program that works that are somewhat free-form in structure, and I guess this applies to Take Four. Now, is there some improvisation involved as well as maybe some non-traditional notation or scoring?
Yes, there is. There's definitely non-traditional scoring. There's no actual improvisation involved because, you know, the people that I originally wrote it for, a classical quartet, and they're not improvisers, but I did take improvisations, a part of the improvisations, like, for example, the famous Parker break from Night in Tunisia, and play with those and kind of spread them, you know, among the players. So I think that the spirit of the improvisation is definitely alive in the piece, even though it's all fully notated.
Now, is that some of the Babbitt coming out in your background, or the jazz coming out, or maybe a little bit of both?
Well, I think they're not mutually exclusive. It's funny because so many people misunderstand. I still can't believe he's gone, but misunderstood Milton, I should say. I mean, he loved jazz. He loved popular music. This was very much a part of kind of his being, and you know his. The stuff that I studied with him was very much a way of kind of organizing what I wanted to do stylistically, even back then when I was a student. The sound that he got out of his music was the sound that he wanted to get. And it's possible to write 12-tone music and have it sound like anything. So I think it's both Milton and it's jazz, and the two of them go together really nicely.
Well, you called your summer in Fontainebleau attending the classes of Nadia Boulanger life-changing. Now, how so compared to your other academic experiences?
You know, it was one of those experiences. I was 19 years old. She was very old. It was at the Palais de Fontainebleau, and, you'd walk down this long hallway in a French chateau, and at the end of the hallway would be Mademoiselle Boulanger with a Cocteau picture of Stravinsky sitting on her piano. I mean, it was pretty amazing.
If I could just back up for a moment. For those unfamiliar with the legendary Boulanger, she's been teacher to some of the most prominent composers of the 20th century, including Darius Milhaud, Aaron Copland, Leonard Bernstein, and then Philip Glass, Astor Piazzolla. Quite a figure. Imposing.
Just being a part of that history was so important to me at that point in my life, that knowing that there was some kind of connection, that there could be some kind of connection. And I think actually the thing that was really life-changing was there's a woman there. She worked with two women. One was Mademoiselle. We had no idea what her last name was. And the other was a woman named Louise Talma. Louise Talma was someone who lived over there And she was very much a protege of Mademoiselle Boulanger. And she taught counterpoint, and she worked with me on Species Counterpoint. She's an American, and she was so tough. And I think for me, at that point, to be working with a woman and to be working with someone with that kind of compositional rigor really shook me up. And so it was life-changing, as are so many life-changing experiences, not in the way that you would think that they are, but in those kind of funny little corners that you don't expect.
Interesting. And from what I've heard, she would impose some basics on you, but allow you to flourish in your own style.
Yeah, I mean, her whole philosophy was, you know, of course, what she said to Aaron Copland and to Piazzolla famously is go back and write the music of your country. And yet, though, and this is the really important thing about all of that training, is it was extremely rigorous musically. I mean, you had to have great ear training. You had to be able to do, you know, Species Counterpoint flawlessly. And so I think it was about really, really creating the musician rather than what we normally think about as training in composition. It was how to become a great musician, which, of course, at that point, you know, being an undergraduate, it pointed me in a different direction. Let's put it that way. Mm.
Well, as I briefly mentioned in my introduction, your composing credits are all over the map. Now, do you have a preference for concert performance, or do you maybe prefer the more controlled environment of the studio?
That's a great question. Both. I mean, what I'm trying to do with, you know, some success, certainly successes and failures, is bring the studio into the concert hall. So in a piece, for example, I did a piece, a funny little string quartet, where I used electronics, but we also projected little videos on iPads that we put throughout the audience. And in even my larger scale, well, the Kitchen Sisters piece that you mentioned is a perfect example, where we used a lot of pre-recorded material, not only their radio stories, but also pre-recorded, pre-processed material that I had done in the studio that then was triggered on an on-stage laptop. So a lot of this kind of stuff that's done in the studio that I've been really used to working with as a recording musician, I'm trying to bring into the concert hall. You know, listen, it's great to record because you do have control and you can fix things. Yet there's a spirit in live performance that you can never capture in the recording hall. So,
sure.
And recording studio. So I think that it's just, you know, it's kind of a toss-up, really.
Well, let's pull back to this coming Sunday's concert and hear an excerpt from Take 4, and we'll let you get some sleep. Laura, thanks again for staying up with us today. Buona notte.
Grazie. Okay. Thank you so much.
Be thinking about us on Sunday, Laura, okay?
I sure will be. I'm so sorry I can't be there.
More with conductor bassoonist Stephen Paulson after this excerpt of the music of Laura Karpman. An excerpt of music of Laura Karpman. You can hear her music this Sunday at the Symphony Parnassus concert. Information at oldfirstconcerts.org. Stephen Paulson conducting that program of works of Brahms as well as Chausson. Stephen's still with me here in the studio. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air. Stephen Paulson, conductor of Symphony Parnassus, performing this Sunday at Old First Church. Stephen, let's shift gears for a moment, put the baton down, and let's get you back in your seat in the bassoon section of the San Francisco Symphony. First of all, congratulations on reaching a contract agreement. I'm sure that couldn't have been any fun for anyone.
No, it wasn't, and we're all very much relieved and eager to get back to doing what we do best, and that is bringing great music to everyone in San Francisco, and that is a common purpose for all of us musicians, administration, and board of the symphony.
And you're still showing support for a sister organization, I understand, that is still suffering from some negotiation problems.
That's a very unfortunate situation. The musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra and the musicians of the St. Paul Orchestra have both been locked out for 6 months, and it's a very upsetting situation there because their orchestras are, the administrations of those orchestras are not doing poorly. They have money, and I can't figure out why they've locked out the musicians. The musicians of the San Francisco Symphony are planning in the near future a big orchestra concert that we're going to produce ourselves to benefit the musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra and the musicians of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra.
Well, we'll keep tuned for that, and we'll be sure to announce it once the final plans have been made. And I also extend my deepest sympathies to you and the entire San Francisco Orchestra family on the tragic passing of your colleague and dear friend, Bill Bennett.
It's been the most horrible month for us, as anyone could imagine, for us who are in the San Francisco Symphony. Bill was a very close friend of mine for the last 33 years. We played together in chamber music and symphony for all those years, and we're good friends. We shared a studio at the Conservatory of Music. And it's so tragic to lose him. I still, quite frankly, have not confronted the reality of it yet.
And again, our sympathies. We talked about the wonderful experience you're getting for your conducting skills by watching MTT and others from the bassoon section. But more than three decades in the symphony sitting in the bassoon section, is there anything in the orchestral repertoire you haven't played?
Well, there are always new things. Sure, there's plenty of stuff that I haven't played. If you look at any period in music, everything is tried. Anything by a composer of any prominence is given a go for their works by the orchestras of their times. And then as time passes, only the cream rises, and so we play the Brahms symphonies, and we don't play symphonies by maybe Brahms's contemporaries who may not be household words, maybe for good reason, maybe not. There may be some gems waiting out there, but it's really difficult to program every piece that's ever been written.
Are there particular guest conductors you're looking forward to when they return? The orchestra seems to respond really warmly, in particular to Charles Dutoit.
Yes.
This week, Herbert Blomstedt is returning.
Well, Maestro Blomstedt is always welcome. I love the way he approaches music, and he seems to be getting younger and younger by the years, not older, which is strange.
Now conductor laureate of San Francisco
yes,
Symphony.
Yes, absolutely. I've had wonderful times under Simeon Bischoff, and Pablo Eras Casado, many others.
Well, one of the spring highlights to come is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which has been considered the most famous and probably, I don't know, you tell me, the most difficult bassoon passage ever written?
There are certain things that do make it the most difficult passage ever written. It's a diatonic solo. It's basically in C major. It's in the highest register of the instrument. So it's not the most technically difficult thing we have to do. But there's a stigma about starting the whole piece where you have 120 musicians on stage and a full house, and then the conductor walks out, and there's applause, and the bassoonist is sitting there, and all of a sudden the applause dies down completely. And that moment of silence is really quite terrifying for a bassoonist. And you have to have your act together to be able to get that first note out. And if you get that first note out nicely, chances are the solo will go well.
Well, let's hear you play that solo now. This is from an unpublished San Francisco Symphony recording, the opening of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. My guest, bassoonist Stephen Paulson, playing.
Thank you.
bassoonist Stephen Paulson with the opening of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Wow, that's some very beautiful playing.
Well, thank you. When I hear it, I think all the things I'm going to improve on it next time we do it.
As musicians, we do that, don't we? Now, those concerts of the Rite of Spring can be heard in later this spring. You can go to sfsymphony.org for full concert details on those. Well, what else is coming up this and next season that keeps you excited about showing up for work?
Well, we're recording another of the most terrifying excerpts for bassoonists, and that is Beethoven Symphony No. 4. Which is just a wonderful piece. It sometimes I actually consider it my favorite Beethoven symphony, although it's not nearly as monumental as any of the odd-numbered ones. It's still just a fantastic piece, beautifully lyrical piece, wonderful parts for the woodwinds. Mm. Not just the bassoon, but just the woodwind choir and clarinet and everybody. So I'm very much looking forward to that, and I believe we're going to be putting it out as a commercial recording.
Fantastic. Well, next season, there's going to, among other things, there's going to be a Benjamin Britten Festival in honor of his centenary. And how is his writing for bassoon?
He writes some really wonderful parts, not in every piece, but I've played some beautiful solos in orchestra pieces by Benjamin Britten. And I must add that Symphony Parnassus will also be participating in his 100th birthday celebration in November 2013. He was born in November 1913, as was my father, by the way. And we're performing at Parnassus a very rarely played piano concerto of Benjamin Britten with Marcus Pawlik as the soloist, and that concert will be on November 3rd.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to have to insist that you return, visit, and spend some more time with me here at KLW down the road, Stephen, if you would be so kind.
David, it will be a pleasure, and it was a pleasure to talk to you today.
And maybe next time enticing you into a live performance.
Okay, I'll bring my banjo.
Thanks for coming in. Bassoonist Stephen Paulson can be heard this season as part of the San Francisco Symphony. Learn more about their upcoming concerts at sfsymphony.org. Conductor Stephen Paulson leads the Symphony Parnassus this Sunday in works of Ernest Chausson, Johannes Brahms, and Laura Karpman at Old First Church here in San Francisco. You can visit symphonyparnassus.org to learn about their upcoming concerts, or for tickets to this Sunday, go to oldfirstconcerts.org for more complete information. We're going to conclude with an excerpt of the Brahms Serenade, which you can hear as part of this Sunday's concert. Michael Tilson-Thomas conducting the London Symphony. In that recording of Brahms' Serenade No. 1 excerpt, provided by my guest Stephen Paulson, who will be on the podium this Sunday for the Parnassus Symphony Concerts. oldfirstconcerts.org for more details. Joshua Cosman joins me once again for a beginning of the month look at the month ahead in classical music. But before we look ahead, let's look back for a minute on what has been in the headlines lately, and that's the strike by the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony. There's been a federal mediator involved, and I kind of wish there was a federal mediator monitoring the press releases that are coming out of the symphony's management. They strike me, if you'll excuse the pun, as demonizing the musicians in extremis. And when you then, in this era of rip-and-read journalism, see those same symphony facts repeated in the press without some other sides, it certainly can't help the musicians' cause.
Well, I think there's arguments to be made on both sides, and I'm certainly in my reporting trying to thread that line between, sure, between the two sides. I guess my feeling is that this is a massive miscalculation on everyone's part. I if you had to force me to say, I'm not sure I could quite tell you who's entirely at fault. I think there's a lot of blame to go around on both sides, and certainly both sides are putting their product and their standing at risk the longer this goes on.
Right. I do need to mention straight off that this segment was pre-recorded on March 28th for broadcast today. So stay tuned at the end of this segment. I'll give you a further update on the strike if there's anything more to say. I think you're right in saying that there's fault on both parties. It couldn't have done anyone good to cancel that East Coast tour.
No, that was really the sign that things were going to get worse before they get better. The issues before the sides are fairly straightforward. It's a matter of whether the symphony as an organization, as a nonprofit, is doing well enough in the current economic climate to be able to maintain the cost of living allowances and the pension increases and the health care benefits that the musicians have come to expect over the years. And the musicians have claimed, with some justification, that the San Francisco Symphony is, in fact, one of the better-off orchestras nationwide. If you look around at the financial hits that some of the other orchestras have taken, they're a lot more severe and they're in a lot worse shape. And so you get musicians taking huge pay cuts because they're playing for organizations that are really up against the wall. The San Francisco Symphony isn't one of those. Conversely, they have run a operating deficit every year for the last 4 years, so it's not as though they're flush with cash.
Right. But we also keep this in context with a very bitter labor dispute that's going on in Minnesota now with the St. Paul's Chamber Orchestra and the Minnesota Orchestra still in on strike, I believe, and the almost strike of the Chicago. It seems like a bad time for labor issues, and it's very difficult to negotiate. I do need to share with you something that was recently posted at a website called musiciansofthesanfranciscosymphony.org, and this was a post by trombonist Paul Welcomer, who says, and I'm quoting here, "Here's a more complete and accurate perspective on why we are out on strike. It really is about the administration shifting priorities without transparency. Our orchestra is thriving, enough to do wonderful media projects, splash out for $11 million year-long celebration, give the high-level management big raises, make our music director the highest paid in the country, take huge tours, etc. He adds parenthetically, "These are all things I have no problem with, by the way." And then concludes with, "But when it comes to negotiating the musicians' contracts, we are expected to give back decades' worth of work rules for a less-than-inflation raise. We simply said no." So that's where it stands as of now. As again, stay tuned to the end of the segment, and hopefully I'll have more of an update on that situation.
Thanks.
And thank you for your reporting at sfgate.com and in the Chronicle.
Thanks.
So from the dramatic and operatic, we move on to opera proper and some April highlights that you're looking forward to. Opera Parallel is doing a double bill of Barber's Hand of Bridge and Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti at Z Space. Now, I'm familiar with Trouble in Tahiti, but not so much with A Hand of Bridge.
A Hand of Bridge is a very short piece. It's only about 10 minutes long that Barber wrote on a libretto by his partner, Giancarlo Minotti. And if you see it at all, it will often be done in partnership with Trouble in Tahiti, because they're both sort of tales of mid-century American suburban angst and anomie, you know, sort of marriages on the rocks. And this production by Opera Parallel, which has been doing terrific work over the last few years in bringing contemporary opera, or recent opera.
Nicole Paimon. Einander, which was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This production promises to be, to invoke that era of Mad Men, which is now so much the rage. And it's perfectly appropriate. Each of these is about married couples that are sort of coming to terms with the dreariness of life in Eisenhower-era suburbia.
Some people have regarded this as an analog to Bernstein's own troubled marriage.
Exactly so.
It premiered in 1952, and just last year, the Orpheus Chamber Ensemble premiered an orchestral version of the suite, mm-hmm. a brand new version of that.
Okay.
And Eugene Branco-Vianou and Lisa Chavez will be starring in that performance, Nicole Paimon and Opera Parallel. Let's hear a little bit of the beginning of Trouble in Tahiti. Set this up for us.
Well, this is one of the wonderful inventions in this piece. This is a sort of a trio of singers singing in very Andrews Sisters style harmony, and they hover over the action as a sort of Greek chorus as the piece unfolds.
Music of Leonard Bernstein here on Open Air. Dystopia in Suburbia for you. Music of Leonard Bernstein and an excerpt with him conducting his ensemble of Trouble in Tahiti. It's a work that you can hear with Opera Parallel under the direction of Nicole Paimon. Once again with Eugene Branco-Vianou in the leading role with Lisa Chavez and the Andrew Sister-esque trio. Information about those performances. By the way, it's at Z Space on Florida Street, and Z is a limited space, so for three performances only, tickets will go fast. Go to operaparallel.org. That's opera, PARALLELE.org. Good pick for April, that's for sure.
And just put the dates in there. That's April 26th through the 28th, that last weekend in the month.
At Z-Space, Trouble in Tahiti. Well, Tahiti seems to be a running theme in your opera picks, as we'll see the world premiere of Fabrizio Corleone's Bonjour, Monsieur Gauguin, on the life of his in Paris and Tahiti of the great painter Paul Gauguin by West Edge Opera.
Yeah, this is a piece I don't really know much about. This is going to be its U.S. premiere. And it's being presented in a co-production by West Edge Opera and the dance company Kunststoff, directed by their artistic director, Yanis Adoniou. So there'll be dancing, projections, video projections, lighting, a whole multimedia kind of thing going on. And what better way to evoke Gauguin's South Sea paradise lifestyle than that? And I want to mention also that they're advertising this as a PG-rated operatic presentation. Evidently, there will be some partial nudity because you can't have South Sea islands and Gauguin without a little toplessness.
Well, all the more reason to catch it now.
Absolutely.
Details at westedgeopera.org. Those productions are April 6th, 12th, and 14th.
Right.
This is a very operatic month for you, isn't it?
It is. It's very true. And even with the San Francisco Opera, you know, out of its usual fall and summer season, but in the interim, we do have a lot of operas coming on and a lot of new and unusual work. One that I'm really looking forward to is coming on April 12th and 13th at Stanford. Stanford Live is going to present the world premiere of two one-act operas, chamber operas, by Stanford professor and composer Jonathan Berger. And these are both operas that are on a single theme, which is internal auditory hallucinations. This one is called Theotokia, and it's about a man afflicted with delusional schizophrenia. The other one, called The War Reporter, which is based on the work of the Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Paul Watson, who, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, is convinced that he is haunted by the ghost of an American soldier whom he photographed in Mogadishu in Somalia in 1993. And in conjunction with these operatic productions, I want to just mention also that there's going to be a symposium at Stanford on that Saturday, the 13th, on the subject of music and the brain. Jonathan Berger, who's the composer, has been not only a composer but also a researcher in various brain-related interactions with music and neurology and perception.
And you've not heard of Jonathan's other works?
I have heard of them, and they get done around here quite a bit, and they're very dark and expressive, and I think perfectly appropriate to these subject matter.
And that's for two performances only at the Bing Concert Hall, the 12th and 13th of April. You can find out more information at live.stanford.edu. On the subject of Bing, I need to throw in a couple of picks myself here. I should mention that the Berlin Philharmonic Woodwind Quintet will be at Bing for a matinee performance on April 28th. Great opportunity to hear those woodwinds. And Laurie Anderson with the Kronos Quartet will be there for two performances on April 20th and 21st. So go to live.stanford.edu. Some wonderful things happening at Bing. I've yet to get down there. So.
Oh, you should. Yeah. It's a wonderful space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else is coming up in April for you?
I'll tell you another thing, and this is also on the operatic front, although back in the 18th century, and that is the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra with music director Nicholas McGeegan is going to finish up their season with Handel opera Tasio, or Theseus. Pretty much every year, the orchestra does a big Handel production, usually in oratorio because they're sort of easier to stage. But every once in a while, we get a full opera. This, I don't think, will be staged. This will be sort of concert production. But this is a little-known opera. I mean, not that any of them are all that well-known. But this is about Theseus and a love triangle that involves him and the enchantress Medea. If you know your Greek mythology, you remember Medea as the spurned wife of Jason of the Argonauts. And when he left her, she destroyed their two children and gave birth to a whole series of plays and operas about her child-killing ways. But this is set after that. She kind of has a second act. It's sort of in refutation of Scott Fitzgerald's line about no second acts. She comes back to make trouble once again for Theseus as he returns from Crete and from fighting the Minotaur. And this is a production that is going to feature the soprano Dominique Labelle as Medea. And if you've heard Dominique Labelle sing with the Philharmonia, as she's done over the years, you know that no performance of hers is to be missed.
And also featuring Amanda Forsyth as the title role of Teseo, soprano role for the male, as was common in Handel's operas. Once again, that's the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, April 10th to the 14th, under direction of Nicholas McGeegan. Information at philharmoniabaroque.org.
And I'll just mention, too, that McGeegan has a history with this piece. If you look up the opera Tasio in the New Grove Dictionary of Opera, as I did the other day, you will find that it had a bad rap for a good 200 years as being a weak and less than satisfactory piece, until a production in 1984 in Boston that McGuigan conducted and directed made everybody kind of go, hey, there's more to this than we thought. So he has a long history of as a champion of this work, which is one of the reasons I'm particularly looking forward to hearing what he does with it.
Also back in town is Andras Schiff, who has been celebrating a whole year's worth of traveling and performing the music of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yeah, and that's really something to look forward to with great anticipation. I think Schiff is one of the great Bach performers, especially on the modern grand piano, which is a kind of a tricky thing to pull off as well as he does. He has absolute clarity when he plays, and a lot of color, and he's got this wonderful sort of ideological thing of not using the piano when he plays Bach on the pedal. That makes more sense. When he plays Bach on the piano, and nevertheless having an enormous wealth of color and sustained tones, and really does a terrific job with it. So the French suites are going to be on April 14th, the English suites on the 21st, both of those in Davies Symphony Hall. And that's a co-production of the San Francisco Symphony with San Francisco Performances, and really a terrific thing to look forward to.
Information for those tickets at the Symphony's website, sfsymphony.org. Joshua, thanks so much. A very rich April ahead for all of us.
Thanks for having me, and I hope when we talk in May that the San Francisco Symphony will be back in the saddle and we can talk about some of their upcoming concerts as well.
I'm pleased to be joined by Stephen Paulson, conductor of Symphony. And as you heard from my guest, Stephen Paulson, that San Francisco Symphony strike is indeed over. The musicians of the San Francisco Symphony are back on the stage of Davies Symphony Hall. Well, music from the English suite of Johann Sebastian Bach to conclude this week's open air. The complete English suites, as you heard from Joshua Cosman, will be performed on the 21st of April. The French suites on April 14th. Information about Andras Schiff's performances at sfsymphony.org. My thanks to co-producer Niels Swinkels. I've been your host, David LaTulipe. Enjoy the music of Bach as we conclude open air. Thanks for listening.